Good afternoon and welcome to the Committee on State and Local Government. Today is Thursday, January 20th, or 30th, excuse me, 2025. And we have a rather short agenda today, but the first bill up, and we do have a quorum now that Senator Swazinski is walking away. First on our agenda, Senate File 563, Senator Hochschild.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, co-chairs. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today to present Senate File 563. This is a bill regarding the Northern Kuching Area Sanitary District. And this bill was heard last year as well, and I believe was included in an omnibus, but just didn't make it through the final end of session. The bill would make changes to the makeup of the board that oversees the sanitary district in Kuching, and I've spoken with all the local elected officials and stakeholders throughout the county who are all supportive of these needed changes. Today, I think I have with me Callie Briggs, the Executive Director of North Kuching Area Sanitary District, who can testify on these changes and why they are needed.
Thank you, Senator Hochschild. Mrs. Briggs, if you could unmute yourself and identify and introduce yourself to the committee and proceed.
Good morning, and thank you, Chair Lang, committee members, and Senator Hochschild. My name is Callie Briggs, and I am the Executive Director for the North Kuching Area Sanitary District, also known as North Kuch. Legislation was set up in the early 1980s to form North Kuch Area Sanitary District, and at that time it had 9 board members, with International Falls having 4, South International Falls having 2, East Kuching having 1, the City of Rainier having 1, and Papermakers 1. Papermakers became non-existent because they did not have a sewer district and still do not to this day, making North Kuch an 8-member board. And in 1989, South International Falls and International Falls consolidated because of a drop in population. At that time, International Falls acquired South International Falls 2 seats on the board. They now dominate the board with 6 representatives, while East Kuch and the City of Rainier each have 1 representative, making up the 8-member North Kuch board. East Kuch is a district that is governed by Kuching County and has had sewer expansions in 2007 and 2018, doubling its sewer hookups. Thus, the reason we are recommending they have another representative on the board. And just for clarification, North Kuch is its own entity and is not affiliated with Kuching County, other than they appoint an East Kuch member to represent them on the North Kuch board. Therefore, the North Kuch board, representing all 3 districts, is respectfully requesting a change in legislation to create a more balanced board, with International Falls having 3 representatives, East Kuch having 2, Rainier having 1, and 1 at-large representative that would be chosen by the appointed board members, creating a 7-member board. Thank you for your time today, and if you have questions, I'll hopefully can answer them for you.
Thank you, Mrs. Briggs. Members, are there any questions to the change of the board makeup? None? No, I think, Senator Johnson Stewart.
No, I'm just, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just giggling because, you know, I love to talk about sewer, so, but I'm gonna let it go this time.
I think this has been more or less through the process last year, and I think this is, I don't remember having a robust discussion on it last year either. I think it was a kind of a good governance bill. So with that, Senator Hochschild, I believe you were still wanting it to go to general orders?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Okay. I think that's okay. The appropriate move, and then we can decide, you know, if we do need to bring it back or what we end up doing.
Okay, sounds good. So members, anybody would like to make the motion? Senator Gustafson, do you like to make the motion?
Yes.
Senator Augustin makes the motion that the bill does pass the committee and move to general orders. All those members in favor, if so, say goodbye by saying aye. Those opposed say nay. The bill is passed and moved to general orders. Thank you, Senator Hochschild. I don't know if you wanted to have a closing comment. I guess I kind of jumped over that part.
Mr. Chair, the only thing I would say is that after this bill, everyone should be able to pronounce Coochaching County. So please practice with me, Coochaching. The best county in the state. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Senator Hochschild.
Mr. Chair, if we could do less controversial bills proceeding for the rest of the committee, I would appreciate it.
Apologize. next on the agenda, on number three, we have the Office of Legislative Auditor Overview. So we have Legislative Auditor Judy Randall, welcome to the committee. Lori Lyson, is that correct?
Yep.
Lyson, okay. The Deputy Auditor. Catherine Thiessen, Director of Special Reviews. And then we also have a late add, Benjamin Freeland from the General Counsel that I believe is, he's on Lottery General Counsel. And I believe he's online. Or is he? He's right here. Oh, hey, Benjamin, how you doing? So if you could introduce yourself to the committee and for the record, and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall, Legislative Auditor. Thanks for taking the time to hear about OLA today, OLA, Office of the Legislative Auditor. We're working on getting our slideshow up, and hopefully somebody can help us with that. But in the meantime, I will just dive in and provide an overview of the office. So we're going to cover a couple of things. One, overview of the office. I think most of you are familiar with OLA, but we'll go into a little bit of the detail. And then we're going to do a little bit of a deeper dive into a newer aspect of our office related to special reviews. It's a growing area, and so I wanted to dive into that a little bit because I was also asked to present some budget numbers for the office, and the growth in special reviews will help to explain the budget request. And then we're going to pivot and provide an overview of a recent performance audit we conducted of the state lottery. So you'll get kind of a full sampling of everything OLA. So first, let's just do the high level. Oh, and before I do this, I do want to acknowledge we have four members of the Legislative Audit Commission on this committee. So this is like, this is great. So you got lots of experts in your midst. Mr. Chair Zhang is one of the DFL members on the Audit Commission. And then we have all three Republican senators who are on the commission, Senator Curran, Senator Drazkowski, and last but not least, arriving in the nick of time, Senator Barr. So I'll get a little bit more into the Audit Commission as we go, but I did want to acknowledge them and their work on the Audit Commission. Okay, so OLA is a nonpartisan office in the legislative branch. We are one of those joint legislative offices similar to the revisor's office and similar to the library. So we serve both the House and the Senate. We serve all 201 members. So that's kind of a distinction between us and Senate Council and Research, for example, which serves is also nonpartisan, also conducts research, but serves the Senate only. We are nonpartisan, and that is a really important part of who we are. The really only bias that we have is good government, and we want government to work well, and that's really the lens we bring to everything. We are independent, and this is really important, and this is something I'll just kind of lean into a little bit. We have independence in several different ways. First of all, we are independent from the entities we audit, in that we are in the legislative branch, and the folks we audit are anybody who receives public funds outside of the legislative branch. So we will not audit you, we will not audit legislative actions, but we audit the executive branch, we audit the judicial branch, we audit private nonprofit organizations that receive state funds. So there's that structural organization of OLA. We also have independence of the auditors themselves. Before a team gets assembled to conduct a specific audit, they have to fill out an independence questionnaire and identify any potential, either actual or perceived, conflicts of interest they might have. Do they have a family member at a certain agency, or do they have some financial exposure to the actions of a certain agency, in which case we wouldn't put them on that audit, we would just put them on a different audit. So again, it's structural independence, independence of the auditor, auditors on a team, and then also there's additional independence construction of OLA in the statutes. Most of the staff at OLA are in the classified service. So unlike all the other legislative staff, they are not in the legislative plan. They are classified service, so civil service. And then the legislative auditor and the deputy legislative auditors are appointed to a 6-year term, and they're appointed by the bipartisan Legislative Audit Commission and can only be removed for cause in a public hearing. So what that enables us to do is just report the facts, report what our research tells us based on the data, based on the information, and without concern if it might upset Mr. Chair or Senator Barr or somebody else, right? We just say it, we call it like we see it, and that independence really allows us to do that. Sometimes we get referred to as the watchdog over public funds. That's kind of part of what we do, but really we do more than that. This is just a quick schematic of our office. It does not include our fabulous support staff, which consists of IT folks, support admin who keep us together, keep everything rolling, and our general counsel and HR and business manager. But up here you see the three key divisions or units that are the report producing groups. So we have the financial audit division, and Ms. Lyson, directly to my right here, is the deputy legislative auditor of that group. We have the program evaluation division. Jody Munson-Rodriguez, who couldn't be with us here today, she is the deputy legislative auditor of that division. And then far to my right is Ms. Tyson, who is the director of our special reviews unit. And so you can kind of see the structure. It's pretty simple. I think sometimes when people think about the legislative auditor's office, they think, well, audit, CPAs, financial audits. And that is certainly what our financial audit division does. They audit the state's financial statements, and they conduct performance audits, kind of control compliance audits of state agencies. But we do more than that. The program evaluation division, you all might be most familiar with that when you think about that survey that comes around and asks, which topics would you like OLA to look at? That those are related to our program evaluations. Those are often focused on ways to make state programs work better. Are they operating efficiently? Are they achieving the goals that you all set out in law? That's kind of the focus of the program evaluation division. And then we have a small but mighty team of four in our special reviews unit, and Ms. Tyson will talk more about what the special reviews do a little bit later. But basically, they're kind of the ad hoc group. They're the folks who receive complaints, allegations, reports from everybody, from agency staff, from whistleblowers, from the public, and that team handles those, sifts through them. We have triage around them, and then dig into as many as our resources allow, which, you know, is limited. Just high level, what's our mission and what are our goals? So we're really about strengthening your oversight, strengthening legislative oversight, providing you all useful information, and we're promoting accountability in government. We're focused on promoting good management, enhancing program effectiveness, and ultimately we try to produce reports that are accurate, objective, timely, and useful. I know that they are always accurate, and I know that they are always objective. I really hope they're useful. We have work to do on timeliness, but we know it, and we're working on it. So I think, you know, 3 out of 4, you know, we're getting there. Okay, I mentioned the Legislative Audit Commission, just a little bit more about that important group. It is a 12-member commission that has oversight over OLA. It is truly bipartisan, and the members on it can attest to that. It has 3 members from each caucus. Doesn't matter who's majority, who's minority, doesn't matter. It's always 3 members from each caucus. And Senator Curran is just finishing up as vice chair of the commission. A couple of important things the Audit Commission does. One, they appoint the legislative auditor to the 6-year term. They conduct performance reviews of the legislative auditor, and then they are also the folks who ultimately select the program evaluation topics. So the surveys that you all fill out gets funneled in through a pretty involved process on selecting topics that we can talk about if you want, but I'm not going to touch on it right now, but we can if you want. But ultimately, it's the Audit Commission that selects those topics on which we conduct program evaluations. And I will just note that that is a big feat, because we usually receive more than 100 different suggestions for program evaluations, and ultimately we do 5 or 6 a year. So it's a lot of work to to scale those down. This, I know I'm kind of zipping through it. I hope if people have questions, they'll stop. I feel like most of you know most of this, but if I'm going too fast, let me know. This slide shows our jurisdiction, and you can see that it is big. We have audit jurisdiction over the executive branch, including the constitutional offices. So we audit the constitutional offices once every 4 years. We just yesterday released a performance audit of the state auditor's office, and we're kicking off one of the governor's office. So we are the auditor of the auditor and also of the other constitutional offices. We also have jurisdiction to audit the judicial branch, higher education, including the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State, metropolitan government, so Met Council, Mosquito Control District, Airports Commission, really anywhere state money goes. And you can see on the slide, you know, down to the Historical Society, down to state contractors, down to grantees. So we have the ability to follow state funds anywhere we need to. In addition to that,
go ahead. Yeah,
I should have a question.
You're all for interruptions, right?
Yeah, I'm all. Is it easier to do it as we go?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Can you go back one slide? On the other, it caught my eye that it says corporations, organizations, and individuals that receive public funds. Are there ever audits of, you know, there are corporations, organizations, and individuals that don't put in funds to the public funds because of whatever, right, exemptions and whatever. Are those ever investigated, that it's an appropriate use of an exemption?
Ms. Randall?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Makewade. Yes, we have done, for example, a program evaluation of the research and development tax incentive, for example. So that would be, you know, it's a tax credit where, I mean, they may have also paid in taxes, but we looked at the use of that credit and the process for awarding it. So
thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
Senator Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Ms. Randall, for your overview. Can you tell us about the extent to which you can track funding or do audit functions with the University of Minnesota, realizing that they have constitutional autonomy? Has that been challenged, or let us know what that looks like?
Ms. Randall?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Drazkowski. We do have audit authority over the University of Minnesota, and even though they have the constitutional independence. We typically rely on their internal audit shop to conduct their audits. They contract out for their own financial audits, but we have done special reviews and some other program evaluations at the university, and we have the authority to do so.
Thank you.
Yep. Good? Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So talking a little bit about our authority and a little bit more on our independence, in addition to statutes giving us really broad jurisdiction, you all have given us pretty strong authority to do our work. Namely, we have access to all documents, all data, all records, et cetera, regardless of their classification. So we can look at any not public data, including the most sensitive things you can imagine. Now, we are subject to the Government Data Practices Act, and we take that responsibility very seriously. So first of all, we don't take into possession not public data that we don't need, right? First of all, limit what we have in our possession, because it's a weighty responsibility. But we do have access to it, we can use it, and then of course we have the ability then to look down, you know, at the granular level, look at trends, look at information, and then roll it up and provide you a summary level conclusion that is not then not public. So having that access to that, the details of the data, a case file, going along on shadowing a nursing home inspector, those types of things allow us to really see what is happening on the ground. But of course, that not public classification remains with us, and we protect that data. All public employees are required by law to cooperate with the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and I am happy to say that really 99.9999% of folks do. We have really good working relationships with the folks we audit. If that doesn't happen, and we have requested information that we need, and they're not providing it. We do have the authority to issue subpoenas. I will say we try not to. I know some folks would like me to use that subpoena power a little bit more freely, not looking at anybody. But I find that we have, you know, longstanding good relationships with folks and want to keep that. That's important to us. So we are able to get the information we need. We also have the ability to protect the identity of sources, and that's really important. So we might conduct a survey of employees. We might conduct a survey of grant recipients. We might conduct a survey of people receiving services, right? Folks who really rely on those services or rely on that grant money or are nervous about their employer. And we have the ability to classify their responses as not public, but then get really candid information. Also, when we're interviewing people, we have the ability to protect their identity. This allows people to really be truthful with us. And people definitely use that protection, and I think it has made our report stronger. I will note we are also included in the whistleblower law, and people have protection as under the whistleblower retaliation law if they report things to us. At the end of the day, our reports are OLA reports. They are not reports that the Audit Commission has endorsed and approved. They are not anybody else's reports. Nobody reviews them to approve them. We do have a review process where the auditee reviews the draft report for accuracy, and we work through that with them. That's the standard part of an audit practice. But at the end of the day, the reports are an OLA product, and I can tell you that we put a lot of work in them. You can't imagine how much to make sure that every line, every phrase, every number, every attribution is accurate. If you can imagine a report as a Word document attached to every sentence, again, sometimes every part of a list, every whatever, there's a comment bubble that references the document in our work papers that supports that phrase, number, statement, and then somebody else has gone in and looked at that work paper and said, yep, you know, I-4, page 7, yellow highlighting, yeah, I think it supports that phrase. And so that's a little bit of why we're struggling on timeliness, but we think the accuracy is that important. Okay. So I think I touched on this already, just the array of our work products. So we do the financial statement audits. We do financial performance audits, which are the internal control and compliance audits. We do IT audits. We're moving towards embedding these IT audits as part of our broader audits too. So for example, today when we talk about the lottery audit, we did an audit of the lottery both from a financial control compliance standpoint, but then also from an IT audit perspective. And so that helps us have a more robust look at the controls and compliance in an agency. We conduct program evaluations, and then we conduct special reviews. And so at this point, I think I'll pitch it over to Ms. Tyson, if that's okay, Mr. Chair, to talk a little bit more about special reviews, because this is really a growing area that I think it would be good for you all to understand more about.
Well, thank you, Ms. Randall. And Ms. Lyson, if you can introduce yourself. Oh, I'm sorry, Mrs. Thiessen. You can introduce yourself and proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Catherine Tyson. I'm OLA's Special Reviews Director, and I'm going to be talking today about what my unit does. So anyone who has information about the misuse of public funds, resources, data, or even noncompliance with state laws is encouraged to report those issues to OLA. And we receive these allegations from legislators, from members of the public, from whistleblowers. Sometimes they even come through media reports. In addition, there's a number of statutes that either require or encourage state employees to report specific issues to OLA. So my team takes in and addresses or assesses each allegation and report to determine the nature and potential impact of the alleged wrongdoing. When warranted, we examine these issues through in-depth special reviews or through other means, and then at the conclusion of our work, my team communicates the results of our work with complainants, affected agencies, as well as key legislators. So I'll give you an example to kind of illustrate our process. In late 2023, a complainant contacted us with concerns about conflicts of interest involving senior leaders of a state board. We requested and reviewed information from the board regarding its efforts to identify and mitigate conflicts of interest. We reviewed applicable laws and policies to determine the board's compliance with these laws and policies. Based on what we found, we wrote a letter to the board encouraging it to strengthen its practices related to disclosing, documenting, and addressing potential conflicts of interest. We also notified the complainant of the result of their complaint, and they were grateful to see that the issue was headed towards resolution. Over the year, this general process occurs dozens and dozens of times, and each time it addresses a new and unique issue. In fact, the total number of allegations and reports that we've received has been increasing over time. The chart on the screen shows this trend from 2020. In 2024, we received a total of 481 allegations and reports. Looking at this data in another way, this chart shows the steady increase in the rate for which we have received allegations and reports. Last year, we received nearly 10 allegations and reports per week on average. So what does this mean for the team of me and my three staff? This means that we're doing more preliminary assessments. We do an assessment for every single allegation or report that we receive, which can involve reviewing the materials that I've submitted with the complaint, interviewing the complainant, identifying and reviewing applicable statutes, session laws, rules, and state agency policies, analyzing financial data, among other research tasks. More allegations and reports also means that we're sending more official communications to complainants and agencies, and I'll be talking about that in the next slide. And frankly, it just means that there's more work that we can do to promote accountability, strengthen legislative oversight, support good management, and enhance program effectiveness. So to give you a sense about how much we communicate with complainants, state agencies, and legislators, I tallied up the official communications my team sent for items received in 2024, and that was over 600 official communications. This includes emails, phone calls, or letters acknowledging receipt of the allegation or report. And we also make phone calls and send letters or send emails telling complainants what we did related to their complaint. When we determine that there is no OLA action necessary or that the issue is outside of our jurisdiction, we really pride ourselves on identifying and providing the resources to the complainant of how they can pursue their issue with a more appropriate office. When warranted, we refer issues to local, state, and federal agencies and to law enforcement. And in order to assess complaints and determine whether a deeper OLA audit, evaluation, or review is warranted, we frequently request information from agencies. Although our special reports or special review reports tend to garner legislative and public attention, the majority of the complaints and reports we receive don't rise to that level of an in-depth special review. But there are instances where we need to dig deeper to determine whether there's a risk to the state of possible misconduct, misuse of resources, mismanagement, or legal noncompliance. And these limited scope projects, which we call inquiries or limited special reviews, you know, they can be about taking an independent look on an already strong process and providing some recommendations on how to further tighten that process, but they can also be about conducting the research necessary to inform legislators about complex government programs and policies. Sometimes the findings from these limited scope projects prompt in-depth financial audits and topics for the program evaluation list. Our limited scope projects often result in a written response, like a letter or a memorandum to the affected agency. They typically involve standard audit and evaluation methods, including legal research and policy and document reviews. In 2024, my team worked on limited scope projects related to over 40 allegations and reports we received. While this might seem like a small number compared to the total that we received last year, working on these limited scope projects accounts for approximately maybe more than half of my team's time. The other half of our time is spent working on in-depth special reviews. So the slide shows the two special reviews that we released in 2024, as well as our ongoing special review on the Department of Natural Resources, Timber Harvest Decisions, and Wildlife Management areas. So with that, I'm going to pass it back to Ms. Randall. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, are we taking questions?
Yeah, I think we can. Senator Johnson, if you have a question.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair and Director Thiessen. Thank you very much for walking us through that. One question I have, though, is since 2020, 2021, roughly, that's almost a 60% increase in your workload. Can you talk just a little bit categorically, like, what are you seeing? What types of reviews or why that increase, and where's that coming from?
Sure.
Ms. Thiessen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. You probably have in your packet this one-page kind of annual report. I'll direct your attention to the top of page 2 to get to answer this question. So you'll see that over time, the types of things that we have received have largely been comparable. We have just been getting more and more of the same types of things. The majority of the issues that we receive are allegations. So it's things that might come from whistleblowers or members of the public, you know, complaints about, you know, something has affected them. State government isn't working how they expect it to. Those are the types of things that are in that allegation bucket. The second most common group of items that we receive is related to data disclosures, and so this would be the inadvertent disclosure of not public government data, and those are reported to us from agencies. You know, it's difficult to say what has driven the increase. I mean, it could be awareness of OLA. It's hard to know. I think really, though, I'll just return to kind of the things that we see have seemed similar over time. We're just simply receiving more of them.
Thank you. Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And from the looks shared, it seemed like maybe you didn't have that handout.
Senator McQuaid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's not about the handout. I actually, I also had a question, but before we go on to the like second part of your thing, which I think is a specific performance audit, would you mind going back to slide 13? Not that far back, just one more. I want to talk a little bit about referring issues to federal agencies. Can you talk a little bit about how those referrals are made, sure. Who receives them? Do you work with inspectors general? And how if do we have them anymore, and how are you working with them?
I guess that goes for anybody at the table.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator, thanks for the question. Try to remember each of the points. Whenever we identify or get evidence of potential criminal activity, we make a referral to the appropriate source. And so if it is something, for example, that might involve state funds, we'll make a connection with BCA and make that referral. Occasionally, we receive complaints or allegations related to the misuse of federal funds, and in that case, sometimes the inspector generals and the federal level that's the appropriate place to send that information. And we do have some contacts within several of the inspector general offices.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, you know, a literal question that I have, like, do we still have inspectors general at all of the federal agencies? And of course there's offices, but if we don't have inspectors general there, I would love to know how that might be impacting our ability to refer back about federal, you know, because it intermixes, right? A lot of federal money comes to the state and then it goes out. So I'm wondering how that might impact your ability to do your work.
Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator McQuaid. I would say most of the time, if we're referring to federal, we're probably referring to the FBI. And so that's who we would work with first. We also would refer to the state inspector generals. So if it is a matter in DHS, for example, we would refer it to the DHS OIG and perhaps work with them. I would say it's pretty limited, the number of things we are referring directly to the federal IGs. And you know, I can't really speak to the state of federal things right now, right?
One more?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I get, the other question is, does it work the reverse way? If we're referring back to federal sometimes, are they ever doing audits and find, oh, hey, there's some state money mixed up in here? And I guess I'm just worried about a lapse there and having that like two-way street where we have some folks watching at the state level, we have some folks watching at the federal level. If we don't have watchdogs at the federal level, are we going to be missing things because they're not coming back to you all?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Makewade. They're really good questions, so I appreciate them. There have been times where we have been reached out, where the federal partners have reached out to us, either to get more information from us or to alert us to issues. Usually, though, in those cases, there's a mix of federal and state money, and so then the feds would kind of take ownership of it. Okay. That's usually how that has gone.
Thank you.
Senator Curran.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just so everybody understands, unfortunately, we may not have people to refer back to in Minnesota. Two of our three Inspector General's offices are actually currently vacant in Minnesota today as well. It had nothing to do with the federal changes at the federal level. So hopefully, and that doesn't include the one new Inspector General office being proposed in this split of DHS. Just for your information.
Ms. Randall, you'd like to proceed? I don't think that's enough for questions right now, right? Good.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Senator Curran is right. There are vacancies in the IG's office at the leadership level, and we have continued to work with folks within those organizations to the best of our abilities. Okay, so I think we are now on slide 16. So this is our budget options, and I was asked to provide this as well. The reason why I wanted Ms. Tyson to walk through our special reviews and that increase in the workload is as a backdrop for the different budget options we proposed to the Legislative Audit Commission this fall. They're listed as options because the Audit Commission didn't take a vote on it. We heard it, and it was before the budget forecast, and so then the Commission decided to wait to take a vote and endorse a specific option. But these were the four that I presented to the Audit Commission, and so I just thought I'd present them to you all as well. Of course, status quo is always an option, and with that, we would continue with our current staff, which are 72. All of our positions are filled, and that's just our current base budget is 11,526, and so we would stay at that, and we would continue to do the work that we're doing. The next option is to increase our staff by four special review staff. That is a doubling of the special review team, but considering all of that work that Ms. Tyson walked you through, it would still be a Band-Aid, I think, honestly, but at least it would help us get more work done, respond more quickly to all of those inquiries we get, respond back to complainants and requesters more quickly in our limited reviews, and be more timely in completing our full special reviews. So four special review staff is that next line. Option three is, you know, four staff, but in our other divisions. As I mentioned, the program evaluation suggested topics usually number over 100 annually, and we do five or six a year. So there's clearly kind of an untapped demand there. And then if you think back to our jurisdiction, all executive branch agencies, judicial branch, et cetera, there's always more work that our financial audit team can do as well. So, you know, options two and three are the same cost, just different allocation internally. And then option four is kind of, you know, going for broke and adding both, right? So going for eight. And I don't want to speak for Audit Commission members, but I will say at the time we presented this to the Audit Commission, the main questions we got were, why aren't you adding eight special review staff? That was really the gist of it. And I think it's a fair question. I think at first when a member said that, Ms. Tyson and I kind of looked at each other, you know, a little deer in the headlight, because that's, remember, it's a team of four, so adding eight, that's a big expansion, and at OLA, whatever we take on, we need to do excellently, and so I don't want to grow too fast that we can't do it well, and so that was kind of my first thought about, oh, eight special review, you know, tripling the size, But the more I thought about it and looked at the need, you know, I think there's some reason to that. I would want to smooth that out. So four in the first year of the biennium and four in the second year of the biennium. Again, to make sure that we grow smartly, wisely, that we continue to meet your expectations of us and our expectations of us. So at the end of the day, I don't have, you know, this is our budget request of the committee, but I just wanted to lay out the options and what we were thinking as we put those together. So just moving on now to the next piece of the presentation. In the past year, this is what we have put out. There's also a lot of those things that you don't see the final product in, as Ms. Tyson talked about, all those limited special reviews and all the communication back and forth with different folks. And frankly, you probably don't see much related to the results of the financial statement audits, but that is what our entire financial audit division, which is around 35 staff, work on for 5 months of the year. So that is another big effort that we do. But these are the main outputs that we did, that we produced in the past year. And so on the next slide, this is just a, well, the font is white, so that's too bad, but hopefully you can see it on your printout. These are the recent audits that we have conducted that are related to organizations under this committee's jurisdiction. And so those are available to you to look at if you're interested. And now we will pivot to go into depth on the recent one we released on the state lottery. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Curran has a question.
No question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Members, you know, the Legislative Audit Commission has, we've done a variety of things over the last few years. I've had the privilege to serve on it since year one as a freshman. And anybody wants to fight for it, I'm not giving up willingly that role. But we've done a variety of things, and Ms. Randall just talked about the budget. We also understand it's one of the few areas where I would grow government today because of the inability to increase the frequency of the oversight of government just on their basic responsibilities, more or less every day, their needs, and you've seen it reflected in the reports that they're growing every day, and the complexity of it grows every day. And so I'm supportive if we want to continue to support them. But we've also done some things over the last couple of years where if we weren't able to keep up with just filling the existing seats and positions. So we changed the salary and compensation packages. We were not losing staff to other or to the external, to the private sector, which we would assume was the trend. We were losing them internally within state government. And so we made some changes and modified so the compensation plans are attractive and reflect the work. There's no other state agency that performs the variation and variety of work that they perform. So we've taken care of that, and Ms. Randall's done a great job, the organizational structure, leadership, and we've got likely some proposals coming to reflect the work in the special review area from an organizational perspective so it succeeds. Ms. Randall, we don't believe she may stick around as long as the last legislative auditor, but so we have done those things. But the other thing I'd like to say is the work that they do and the things that we expect from them as an organization like no others from a political perspective, right? We have policies, we've debated, and their employees run for office. None of those things are allowed in that entity. And what they need to do to make sure that to maintain a nonpartisan, bipartisan, neutral position in their personal lives, it carries forward and impacts every element of work that they do. So we commend them. We also work extraordinarily hard, I think, in that bipartisan, bicameral environment to ensure we keep the institution. They are the only eyes and ears for us and the citizens of the state of Minnesota that provide any oversight to state government. So we're lucky to have them, and we've all tried to make sure that we move and migrate into the next greatest version of who they are and what they do and perform. So they've done a spectacular job. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Curran. And Senator Gustin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to echo some of what Senator Curran said too. You are, whether you know it or not, have strong reputation from both sides of the aisle for the work that you do and how well you do it. As you know, there are going to be some bills coming forward in this committee that will talk about some other things that we can do to build on your work. But I just wanted to take a moment to say how much we appreciate what you have been doing, because we know it's a lot and it's probably thankless, and a lot of it's behind the scenes and probably a lot of it misunderstood. So I just want to say thank you. We've had several meetings that I've really appreciated. Want to continue to move forward as we look at some other ways that we can build on what you're doing, and excited to continue those conversations. And thanks for being here today.
I guess I'd just like to say thank you before we get into the report here. Just in the last few years, you know, Minnesota has had a staggering amount of fraud, waste, and abuse that both you and the federal government have been reporting on and dealing with. And I think Senator Gutsman hit on a good point when I think the state is making a move to preemptively stop some of this fraud, where you've never really had that ability other than looking at something and saying, here's what's going wrong and here's where the money's going. We don't do it preemptively. So I think the state is definitely moving in the right direction, but I do appreciate the work. I mean, you guys don't miss much. A 40-page report, I've seen 140-page reports that I take weeks to dig through. I can't imagine what it takes to put those together. And I think you've seen legislation over the last few years, too, that coincides with what you recommend, coincides with, okay, this, or even to the point where here's our best guess on how to fix it because of what the OLA has said. And here, as a body, this is what we're going to do. You've seen it on all kinds of different agencies, every topic from EMS to the Feeding Our Future stuff that we're working on. It's across the board. So again, appreciate it. Thank you for your time here, and looking forward to the report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and senators. I really appreciate your support. And, you know, at the end of the day, we're here to help you, you know, remember the useful part. And so if there are other things that we can be doing to help you, you know, please let us know, because that's what we're here for. So thank you. And now I'll turn it to Ms. Lyson. Thanks.
Thank you. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that has come up lately in our conversation, my conversations, has been the public data versus private data. And how much, where do you run into that line where you cannot publish certain instances? And I'm looking at the sheet that was handed out here. We have, in 23-24, no action necessary. So evidently, this was a complaint, but it didn't lead anywhere. Is that data available? What has happened? What complaints and what has happened to those investigations that allow you to set them aside?
I believe that would be open for anybody at the table again.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I would say the vast majority of the items that are in that no action necessary bucket tend to be issues that state agencies report to us under their reporting obligations in law. And we determined that there's no additional action necessary because we've collected the information to support that those agencies are taking the steps they need to. So let's say, hypothetically, an agency reports possible misuse by a grantee, and they're going in and reviewing the records and taking action against that grantee. We may have some follow-up questions. We would definitely want to see the final result and verify that that work was appropriate. But, and another example, I think, would be those data disclosures or data breaches. You know, there's requirements in law for how to handle a data breach. When we get those reports, we ensure that the agencies are taking the actions necessary and might monitor, but there's no additional OLA work at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Ms. Fox. Senator Carlson.
Follow-up, Senator, yeah, Mr. Chair. So I guess when that decision is made that there isn't any more information, and you've already fed back to the complainant, is there some place where the public can get a listing of those complaints that have been set aside?
Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson. So our section of law talks about the data classification of this, so it's under 3.979. The short answer is there's a limited set of data that would be available. So it's the audits, the existence, status, and disposition, and that would be it. So we couldn't really get into the details. We certainly couldn't identify the complainant or things like that, but we can kind of do the top line of information related to those complaints.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, got a couple down there. Senator Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, members, I find it interesting, and thank you for your testimony on that particularly. So we have agencies that are coming forward and exercising their responsibility to report to you, which is in two places in law that agencies, people in government, if they believe there's money going out against the law, are required to report to you. And so we just heard, members, that there are many agencies doing this regularly. It sounds like some fraction of 600. At the same time, with the Feeding Our Future fraud, we had the entire Department of Education that did not report to the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Let me say that again, members. They did not report according to the requirements under law in two different laws, while the rest of the agencies are reporting things that don't require follow-up, that they're just exercising their responsibility under the law and doing the things they're supposed to do. But our entire Department of Education failed, or some might think refused, to follow the law and report to the Office of Legislative Order. No response required, Ms. Randall and staff, but I think this is very, very stark in its reality as we think about that here today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Randall, into the report, I would say.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Drazkowski. Yeah, I guess I will say that we are working on and really close to finalizing reporting guidelines that we are going to be sending out to all agencies to really help them understand what we do expect them to be reporting to us under the law.
Thank you. Ms. Lyson, I got it right again.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Lori Lyson. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor for the Financial Audit Division. And as Ms. Randall said, I'm going to cover our performance audit from the Financial Audit Division of the Minnesota State Lottery, which does cover IT in a non-IT focus. So the lottery was established in 1989, and they're responsible for operating the Minnesota Lottery. And they contract with more than 3,000 retailers throughout Minnesota. They're located in gas stations, convenience stores, and grocery stores. And they sell these retailers sell tickets like the multi-state lotto games, such as the Powerball and Mega Millions, those lotto games that are only sold in Minnesota, which is go for five and pick three. And then they also sell the various scratch games that are also only sold in Minnesota. So the net proceeds from the ticket sales are deposited into the state's Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, and then also in the general fund. So also, the lottery is we all know it's a state government agency. However, the Minnesota statutes exclude the lottery from MINIT's technical management policies and oversight, which is important to know as we go forth in this presentation, that they don't have to adhere to MINIT's policies and procedures, and they don't have oversight from that agency. So what that means is the lottery manages and maintains its own information technology operating environment. So from an IT perspective, it's important to understand the lottery's core gaming systems. That includes the central gaming system and then the internal control system. Those systems interface with the terminals at the retailer locations, and they record all the sales transactions, they manage the inventory, and they validate the winnings. These systems are the backbone of the lottery, and they're critical to the integrity of the lottery's games. These systems are developed and they're implemented and they're supported by third parties. The controls and security requirements for these systems are dictated by the Multi-State Lottery Association, which is also goes by the name of MUSL. And then every 2 years, MUSL does do a compliance audit of the lottery, and that last one occurred in 2023. So for this audit, our objectives were to determine if the Minnesota State Lottery had adequate internal controls, whether they complied with significant legal requirements that we tested, and whether they had appropriate security administration procedures and controls. And then we also looked to see whether they resolved prior audit findings. Our audit scope ranged from July 1st of 2021 through December 31st of 2023. So our audit results ended with 11 findings, and we have two kind of separate conclusions here. We have one conclusion over our internal controls that we looked at, and we found that the lottery generally did not have adequate internal controls. Specifically in the IT portion of our audit, we looked at whether they protect the integrity of the lottery's IT systems in their operating environment. So this included understanding the controls that are required by MUSL, but also best practices, those standards that are out there by best practices. And then if we switch over to the second conclusion, that's really looking at compliance, and that was primarily over our non-IT area. And we found that the lottery here generally did comply with significant legal requirements that we tested, but we did find some findings related to noncompliance in the areas of retailer background checks, retailer contracts, and then lost or stolen tickets. So we last audited the Minnesota State Lottery back in 2016, and we had 9 findings. So going forward in our report, I'm going to talk about a few of those. The lottery did resolve 5 of those prior audit findings that included findings related to IT policies and then ensuring whether retailers were not lottery employees or family members. And then they partially resolved 3 of the findings, which I'm going to talk about further on upcoming slides. And then there was one prior audit finding that we did not include within the scope of our audit. And then on page 9 of the report, there is kind of a layout of those prior audit findings and the resolution of those. So in the IT-related area, we looked at the lottery's gaming systems, we looked at physical security, we looked at access management, network security, vulnerability and configuration management, and then incident response and disaster recovery. I'm just going to highlight 3 of the IT findings, and those focus on access management and incident response and disaster recovery. So for system access, we audited the access control mechanisms, including how individuals gain access to various systems at the lottery, and then the actual access that they have. We concluded that the 2016 finding related to system access limitations was only partially resolved here, and that is due to the following 2 findings. The first finding was that the lottery has not performed an annual review of system access to access granted to employees as required by its policies. And then the second finding, which is a potential effect of that first finding, was that we found that the lottery did not have adequate separation of duties among key IT system administrators. So what that means is that some of lottery's IT staff essentially had broad administrative access throughout the entirety of the IT's environment, which means like they had the keys to the kingdom, right? They could really do anything that they wanted to do, and they also had the ability to cover that up. So the areas was access management, security and monitoring systems, various servers and other areas. So because of this, obviously the risk of compromised account or an internal bad actor and the amount of damage that they can do is obviously increased here. So our recommendation is that the lottery perform an annual review of its systems and the accounts to ensure that there's a proper separation of duties here. And then our next finding, if you track any of our IT findings or our reports, you'll see that we oftentimes look at incident management and disaster recovery. It's something that really shows that an agency and their systems are able to be recovered at a time of a major incident. So here we determined that the lottery had not adequately documented, tested, or trained their IT staff, or their staff altogether, to respond to a significant incident that impacts their IT systems. So currently the lottery's incident response plan also was not approved by executive leadership. And further, the lottery had not performed detailed training exercises of its plan on how to respond to an incident. Oh, thank you. Apologies. So while the lottery has numerous technical controls in place to increase resiliency, so they have a lot of redundancies, what they haven't done is they haven't done the testing and training of staff, and they haven't had that oversight from leadership of the approval of that. So our recommendations here are that the lottery should improve its documented incident response procedure based on its likely impact and other factors. They need to ensure that post-incident reviews are documented, such as lessons that were learned. They need to include stakeholders throughout the agency, and they need to perform that regular testing and training. So then if we kind of switch over to our non-IT area of testing, we looked at lottery retailers and the scratch games. We also looked at whether the lottery resolved the prior audit findings, and then we did do a survey of permanent employees, which I'll talk about. So I'm just going to cover two of the findings and also our survey response. So for this first finding related to background checks, we found that the lottery did not verify that retailers did not have disqualifying convictions. The convictions are listed there on the right side of the slide. Statutes prohibit the lottery from contracting with retailers that have convictions within the previous 5 years. And so previously, the lottery's background checks were processed by a nationwide check through the Department of Public Safety. However, now the lottery performs their own background checks, and they do this by searching public records. That's not going to include convictions outside of the state of Minnesota. So, for example, this pretty obvious example, but if you have a retailer that has a gambling offense in Wisconsin, the way that the lottery is currently performing their background checks, they're not going to be able to see that conviction in the state of Wisconsin. So our recommendation is simple. The lottery needs to verify retailers have not been convicted of disqualifying crimes, and we think that's nationwide. And then our next finding is about retailer contracts. So we found that the lottery permitted retailers to, with expired contracts, to continue selling lottery tickets, which is prohibited by statutes and rules. So to continue to operate as a retailer without a contract, obviously it violates state law. And as a result, the lottery could be contracting with a retailer who is no longer eligible. So we have two recommendations here, that the lottery should not permit retailers with expired contracts to sell tickets, and they should implement, once again, internal controls so that the retailer contracts are renewed prior to their expiration date. And then through our work, we identified some potential concerns with leadership and supervisors. To determine the extent of those concerns, we surveyed all 146 permanent employees, and we received a response back from 126 of those employees, so that's approximately 86, and it crossed all 8 divisions within the lottery. And so our finding is that many lottery employees indicated concerns about the lottery's workplace culture, and we asked questions regarding executive leadership and direct supervisors in areas such as communicating a clear vision, recognizing employees and their achievements, valuing employee input, sharing information in a timely way, and also providing clear direction. So our results show that many respondents had concerns about executive leadership, whereas a majority seemed to be overall satisfied with their direct supervisors. So for example, when we asked about whether executive leaders and their direct supervisors valued employees' input, 52% of respondents disagree or strongly disagree that executive leaders valued their input, whereas 81% of respondents said they agree or strongly agree that their direct supervisors valued their input. We also asked whether employees received appropriate responses to their informal concerns. We had 40% of respondents that said they had expressed an informal concern at some point to lottery human resource staff or to other leaders and supervisors. And again, we have a very similar pattern here, where 78% of respondents said they did not receive an appropriate response from direct leaders and then 77% of respondents said they did not receive an appropriate response from human resources. On the other side of that, with direct supervisors, 54% of respondents did receive an appropriate response.
So our recommendation here is that the lottery should evaluate agency practices and make changes to promote a productive work environment. That concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Layson. Members, are there any questions from the testifier? Senator Barr.
I'll start. I know there's a ton of questions on this. You were talking about some of the controls that are in place. Have you noticed any holes where in the sales where a minor could go in and buy lottery tickets because it's 18 and above to buy lottery tickets or to participate? Is there scratch-offs or anything like that? Did you see any major holes in there?
Any testifiers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. We didn't do specific testing, and I think lottery would be better to speak to this, but there is some electronic gaming systems that do have the ability for somebody under the age of 18 to use that electronic gaming system. We didn't look at any testing of that because it is permitted under criteria that they can allow for that, but it is something that we didn't test further. And like I said, I think the lottery would be better equipped. And I think Ms. Randall is going to add here.
Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Barr. Just to piggyback off what Ms. Leisen said, I know that there are vending machines that do not check, you know, you don't have to swipe a driver's license or anything to prove your age, and you can buy the lottery tickets from them, from those machines. My understanding is that to redeem the lottery ticket, you would have to do that with a person and prove that you are 18, but we did not test it.
Thank you. Members, any additional questions? Senator Curran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Leisen, we did this report in November 2024, and I think we've at least done or are going to attempt to do some follow-ups. Have we followed up with at least a couple of the most egregious? Do we today have vendors operating with expired contracts?
Anybody?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Grant. Yes, we have not yet followed up. We do plan on following up probably a year from now.
Mr. Chair. If I can add to that, I do know that there's a representative from the lottery here, and we have been told that they have addressed those concerns, but I'll let them speak.
Mr. Freeland, would you like to come up this time?
Sure.
Okay. Can we get Mr. Freeland a chair?
Oh, all right.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Ben Friedland. I'm the lottery's general counsel and an assistant director. I do have a prepared statement, or I'm happy to just answer questions, however the chair prefers.
How long is your prepared statement, I guess? Is
that? Maybe 2 minutes?
Yeah, go ahead with that.
All right, I appreciate it.
Could address Senator Curran's question shortly thereafter.
Sure. Let me start with the question.
Okay.
That was one of the findings that was fully remediated earlier this month. There are no retailers selling tickets without a valid contract. We put in the controls in place that if a contract had expired without a renewal, that retailer would have been shut off. I was happy to say that with a ton of hard work, we didn't actually have to turn off anybody. We were able to get the renewals in place in time so that everyone was operating with a valid contract. But if you'll indulge me a moment, thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm Ben Friedland, the Assistant Director at the Minnesota Lottery. Adam Prock, the lottery's executive director, is unfortunately dealing with a family medical emergency today and is unable to attend. We look forward to giving this committee a complete overview of the lottery's work and recent successes in the future, and we're available at the committee and all the members' convenience to provide a point-by-point update on the OLA findings. However, I appreciate the opportunity to give you a brief overview of the steps we are taking to strengthen our operations and our responses to the performance audit conducted by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. I would note that additional information is contained in our formal response, which is attached to the audit. First and foremost, I want to assure you that we are committed to resolving the findings identified in the OLA audit. The audit has been a valuable tool in finding areas of improvement in our operations, And the lottery would like to thank Auditor Randall and her team for providing a detailed look at our operations. Importantly, the audit found no reportable concerns related to the integrity of our games, proceeds, or financial systems. It did, however, highlight areas where we need to strengthen internal controls, ensure compliance with existing policies and procedures, improve security practice, and enhance workplace culture. Even before we received the report, we immediately began work to address the recommendations and set internal deadlines to do so. As of today, the lottery has fully remediated 4 of the 11 findings. The issues related to expired contracts, reviewing access attempts, third-party security guards, and complex passwords have been fully resolved. We expect to remediate the 4 findings related to compliance with IT policies and disaster recovery by the end of June 2025. These issues are more complex and take time and resources to properly resolve, but they are the top priority of our IT and security teams. Regarding the employee survey, the lottery has begun work with outside experts to implement the recommendations related to employee satisfaction. Increasing employee engagement, buy-in, and overall satisfaction is an ongoing project and a high priority for all lottery leaders. Regarding the final 2 findings, finding 3 relates to the treatment of lost and stolen tickets. As noted by the OLA in the report, this can be resolved through administrative rulemaking. We have started this formal process, and this issue will be resolved promptly. Finding 1 relates to the scope of background checks required by officers, directors, and owners of corporate retailers. We are committed to working with legislatures and other stakeholders this session to clarify Minnesota Statute 349A06, which governs our background check process for lottery retailers. The current law does not explicitly define the scope of the background checks required, which has led to confusion. With your support, we will work to update this statute in the 2025 legislative session so that we can protect lottery games in the state of Minnesota while cutting unnecessary red tape in the retailer contracting process. In summary, the lottery has remediated or has a plan to remediate each of the findings in the November audit. The lottery remains dedicated to offering fun, secure, innovative entertainment that generates income for the state, and we recognize that as we grow and evolve, we must continue to uphold the highest standards of transparency, accountability, and service to Minnesotans. The OLA audit has provided valuable feedback, and we are committed to taking the necessary steps to address all of the findings. Thank you for your time, and I am happy to answer any questions about individual findings.
Follow up, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Friedland. I'm glad that there's nobody operating without a contract right now, and I think you described it as it was a lot of hard work. It should have been a lot of hard work performed long before the audit occurred. And so we hope that continues and that no one should ever operate without the contract. Thus moves into my second point is the change, right, should coincide to do that adequately ahead of time. And as we work through what the security or the background checks are required, I know the BCA changed the requirements, and you guys chose the least restrictive option. And just so members understand, I think Ms. Lyson talked about the limitations. We check only state background checks for those that reside in Minnesota. And then anybody who resides outside of Minnesota, they literally chose, I believe, against recommendations from their staff to just request a self-attestation. So promise not to cheat, promise to be good, or promise your background check is good. We don't do that anywhere. And so we believe that we would have provided a lot of grace if we would have continued and you operated in a manner that was more restrictive and we think the intent of what the statutes currently say. Because if we tell us that they didn't currently say they're prescriptive enough, then why did we do the thorough background checks prior to getting to this point? And so we want to get to that point where everybody has the same thorough background check, and we understand the scenarios you provided in the committee. What about a Walmart? We can come up with a very practical solution, who those people are, specifically to the location, to make sure background checks are done. That should have been your priority, to seek that grace long before we got to this review. So have you put forth legislation, some recommended language that we should consider? And if so, where is that in the process?
We've drafted the legislation. It has been through the revisor's office. It is going through the executive branch processes, and we expect to introduce it very soon.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all I have.
Okay. Chairman John.
Thank you, Co-Chair Lang. Just unless anybody else has any other questions, maybe we can let Dredd.
You want me to skip you?
Yeah,
you want me to skip
you?
It's Senator Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Freeland and Ms. Lyson, if you've got anything to say about this too, but I was looking at the findings from 2016, and finding 8 says the Minnesota State Lottery did not fingerprint and conduct all required background checks for its temporary employees. Although it's a different group of people, it's a similar behavior by the agency and not doing background checks and selectively apparently not doing them, and says it was resolved for 2016. And then we get past that resolution and the agency decided to not properly do background checks for its retailers. Is there a relationship there, or what? I'm seeing like a thread here. What's, Mr. Freeland, can you tell us what's happening there?
Mr. Freeland?
Senator, Chair, I don't believe there's a relationship between those two issues. We resolved the first, and we will resolve the second.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Drazza.
Thank you. Mr. Freeland, so the Office of Legislative Auditor, Mr. Freeland, did an audit in 2016 and cited your agency for not properly conducting background checks. At that point, it was for employees. And then your agency changed the practice, the agency's practice for doing background checks for retailers after that point in time. And it's not as though something just cropped up. And we had this argument when you were before the Legislative Audit Commission, and your agency staff, I don't remember if it was you or someone else, seemed very belligerent at the time, thinking that what your agency did was just fine. And no one else in the world was on the same wavelength with you. It appears that you, as an agency, decided to peel back the approach for doing background checks, which before that point in time was to do the full-blown background check. And there was a deliberate decision on the agency somewhere to stop doing it that way. And as Senator Cran pointed out, you decided to only do it by looking up, using a workaround to only look up state of Minnesota examples. And that left a wide open area. So it's the same behavior, Mr. Freeland. So when you see the same behavior, you got to ask the question, is there some other problem that's contributing to this? And we still haven't discovered, and I don't remember any testimony in committee about why the decision was made to peel this back. There seemed to be a bunch of dodging going on to those questions as well. But Mr. Freeland, if you can share any light on the subject, I think the committee and the state of Minnesota would like to know too.
Mr. Freeland.
Senator, Chair, thank you for the question. The lottery has a system of numerous technical and legal controls that are designed to make sure that the games are safe, the games are secure, and that suitable people are owning and operating lottery retailers and lottery vendors. We endeavor to comply with the law the best way we can while still operating sort of as a small business within state government that isn't imposing red tape burdens or asking for more than what is required to meet the law and to keep the games and to keep the agency secure. There's a respectful disagreement between the OLA and the lottery on the scope of the required background checks under the law, and we think that the best solution is to do a really good, really deep background check on the right people, on the people who have influence on the games, who have influence on on our vendors, but to not do that deep background check on people who have no relationship to the Minnesota Lottery. And that's trying not to get out over our skis, but that's the direction that we are going with the legislation that we'll be proposing.
Is Senator Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Friedland, I think that you'll find members here and probably throughout the legislature that want to go a different approach. Sure. They would like to actually have the law enforced the way that it's written now, at least the way that many of us believe as we interpret that it should have been carried out, which was the way you were carrying it out before you decided to take a different approach. And I would ask you, Mr. Friedland, the opinion on where we should go here, whose opinion is more important, yours or the legislature's?
Senator, Chair, obviously the legislature's.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I asked the question earlier, with a vending machine, how do you verify that underage people are not using the vending machine?
Mr. Freeland.
Senator, Chair, the way we do vending machines is, and this is an industry-wide practice that's done throughout the country, we give retailers essentially two options, and they must choose one or the other or both. And those two options are, one, to keep the machine in line of sight so that there is an employee that's right there looking at the machine, able to check to see if people under the age of 18 are purchasing, or to use ID verification. And some of our retailers use ID verification, some of them don't, some of them choose line of sight, some of them choose both options, but that's an industry standard. And just generally, I'll say that we absolutely do not want underage people buying lottery tickets, and that's something that throughout our agency, responsibly selling lottery tickets is of the utmost importance to us.
Senator Barr.
So I'm gonna put a couple pieces together here. So if you have a retailer selling lottery tickets, and how do they get the reimbursement? Is it percentage of sales, or is it a percentage of bigger winners? How does the retailer get reimbursed?
Senator, retailers receive a commission on sales. That's their primary way of being reimbursed.
Senator Barr.
So how do you reimburse on a vending machine?
I understand the question. Senator, the vending machines are treated as sort of another outlet of a retailer. So a vending machine in Cub Foods has to ask for it, and Cub Foods operates it, and Cub Foods stocks it, and it's their responsibility.
Senator Barr.
So Cub Foods is an example of where you could have line of sight, although whoever's supposed to be watching is probably busy doing other things. I know of a couple of places where they're unmanned, like laundromats, car wash. I mean, I know laundromats specifically has quite a few of these. There's nobody there, and I know for a fact that they don't have an age verification like swiping a driver's license on the lottery machine, because I've seen people walk up to it, just put a $20 bill in and buy tickets. So I'm kind of curious, what does the lottery do to actually verify that there's an age verification on here? And if you're going to be reimbursing that at a percentage, there's nothing, they're not doing anything. Is it just, it seems to be there's an incongruity there between somebody who's actually paying a payroll for somebody to dispense tickets like at a convenience store, and we parked a vending machine that we're not keeping an eye on because it's an unmanned facility and anybody can walk in and use it.
Mr. Freeland.
Senator, Chair, I'd love to take this conversation offline and find out what store that is, because that should not be permitted.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Barr.
The question isn't taking it offline. The question is, what is the lottery doing to verify that doesn't happen?
Mr. Freeland.
Senator, Chair, the lottery has, I would say, two mechanisms for verifying this. And it's unfortunate if something has fallen through the cracks, but we have a sales team that goes to the retailers, including retailers that just have vending machines. They go around the state looking at retailers, working with retailers, finding ways to improve lottery sales and ensuring that they have the right responsible gaming materials present, and that they have the odds posters posted and complying with the law. We also have a security department that works on those sorts of issues. So we take those issues seriously, and I'd like to follow up on this specific instance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator McQuaid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to get a sense of, I'm looking more at the company culture part of it, and I don't usually do math in public, but I'm looking at the majority of respondents, 101 of the 146 permanent staff surveyed were individual contributors. So most people who are talking about, most people aren't direct supervisors. Am I accurate? Okay. And so of the people who are direct supervisors, there was high satisfaction with their response to things, and it was the executive leadership that we were seeing issues with. I did read about the return to work piece potentially playing, I couldn't tell if it was an outsized role because it is mentioned, or if it's just the thing that had happened right at this time, and so it was just playing a large role. Can we just talk a little bit about that? The return to work, has there been a difference in output, in execution, in accuracy, in any of it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator McQuaid. Maybe I'll take the first part on the survey, and then you can take the part on the effect it has had. I will say that in the survey responses, when people wrote in unprompted, they weren't talking about return to work as the things that they were unhappy about. Now, it is something that had happened in proximity to when we conducted the survey, so it may have influenced it. I know that is, at least the lottery staff have ascribed some of that response to that recency, but that's not what we saw in our responses. But I'll let Mr. Friedland perhaps respond to the effect of bringing folks back into work on efficiency.
Mr. Chair, if it's actually not what people wrote in about, I'm not that interested, to be honest with you. Could you talk a little bit more about what folks did write in about?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator McQuaid. So I'm butting up against the not public information. Mm-hmm. And so I think I would like to be a little cautious on what I say publicly, and I can provide the committee some information as a follow-up. Thanks.
Okay. One more?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I will say that I am interested as a human being, you know, I want the workplace of the state to be a good place to work. If the pieces you could follow up about are actionable by legislators, then I would definitely want to know. If it's not, then, you know, for my interest is piqued and it could be satisfied, but I don't know if that is doesn't need to be a top priority for you there. That was all I had. That was sticking out to me, the workplace culture
Sherman
piece.
John, you're on next on the list.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Chair Lang. I just had a question. You know, we had some discussion on, I think, from both caucuses and the governor looking at potentially some legislation for an office of OIG office. And in your work, you know, you mentioned that there's other state, OIG offices that you work with. You know, do you feel that it's been complementary? Have there been cases of overlap? I don't know if you've gotten a chance to look at some of the bill proposals this session and give us your take on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Chair. So generally, I would say that the work of OLA and an state OIG can absolutely be complementary. There's a lot of work, unfortunately, to go around. The way I think about it is OIGs tend to go really deep, and they're really knowledgeable in specific program areas. So I think of DHS OIG, which is embedded in DHS, and let's say they're the group looking at complaints related to CCAP. Right? They know those program rules really well. They know the licensing rules. They know the licensors. And they have access to those data systems. And so they can go really deep and look at the recipients, right? Look at the providers of those services, look at the recipients, and look to see if there's something not going well there. OLA has the authority and the jurisdiction to go down to that level, but we don't often, or we do in the context of looking at what is the agency doing to ensure the providers are the right providers, to ensure the recipients are the right recipients. So we'll go down to that level to get information to then look at the state agency and say, state agency, are you doing what you should be doing? I think of an OIG looking more at licensee, provider, are you doing what you should be doing? So if they're separated that way, I think they can be complementary. And so when we get kind of some of those really deep, very specific allegations on a specific site, we do have the jurisdiction to look at it, but it might make more sense for somebody embedded in that program to look at it. With all the conversations that have been happening, you know, we have had several internal conversations of, you know, because folks have said, well, why doesn't OLA just take on the OIG, right? Why don't you just do that work? And we've been reluctant to embrace that opportunity. And one of the main things that we keep coming up against is there are over 2,800 different systems, computer systems in state government. And if you think about what I just said about what an OIG needs to do to go deep and really know the ins and outs and the data, we would need to, you know, forget tripling special reviews. We would need so many staff to become experts in everything that could possibly pop up. So I really believe that having strong embedded IGs might be the most successful path. But I mean, I think there's a lot of different ways to skin that cat. So I think I've rambled and gone off topic a little bit, but I'll say I think they can be complementary.
Certainly. Well, thank you, Chair, and thank you. And I think it's certainly an area of interest, and I'm sure we will have robust conversations going forward. And I, you know, I'm one of the newer members to the Legislative Audit Commission, you know, serving with very, very knowledgeable other commission members here. So, you know, when the reports come out, do you have a set schedule that you put it out, or is there a criteria for, you know, if a report was coming out, or do you issue, like, statements too?
So thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Chair. So our reports, we have a loose schedule, is what I would say. We kind of have seasons. So our program evaluations tend to come out around now. So we're releasing the second program evaluation tomorrow, looking at the Department of Health's Human Resources Department. So program evaluations tend to be released January to March. Financial audit, performance audits tend to be released September to December-ish. Again, timeliness, we're working on it. And then special reviews come out when they're ready. In general, we try to get reports out as quickly as we can, as long as we have done our due diligence and all the, you know, verification and accuracy work. So we don't have a strict schedule, but we usually put out a notice about a week before we're going to release a report so that we alert people, we offer briefings, things like that. As legislative auditor, I don't put out a special statement. We don't hold press conferences. We don't do anything like that. We send out a notice to folks who have signed up for notices to say, we have released this report. We do a tweet that is about as auditor-y as it can be, which is, we have released this report. You know, I'm trying to do a monotone. You know, so we just kind of, it's just information, and we post it on our website. And then it kind of enters the dialogue, right? Often the Audit Commission will have a hearing, sometimes not, depending on timing. Oftentimes standing committees will have hearings, sometimes not. But we always post it on our website, and then it's kind of out there for dialogue.
All right. Thank you, Chair.
Senator Cran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think the one piece we didn't cover about the structure of the OLA is over the last 4 years, members, we put together, there's a lot of historical just best practices, maybe not the best practices, but we didn't have any structure about how we do overviews or performance reviews or anything from the office. And so now we have Ms. Randall's on a six-year term. Every year we do a performance review. An annual review consists of a self-assessment. We do peer review. A couple members take up and go out and do interview staff and agencies. And then every half term, which we're in right now, we're in where we seek outside counsel to kind of just provide or consulting to provide a review as well. So those things weren't in place before. So I think we're, again, operationally and organizationally, we're in a very good place to make sure these things succeed us when we move on, and we can hand this off to not this dark hole, but a lot of good structure supported by the LCC to make sure this organization and us as members can and understand what those roles and jobs are, the responsibilities of the committee. Not only that, the opportunities, how we support and make sure that organization is run very well. And so I think that's it, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate it. Thank you, Ms. Randall and team.
Senator Barr, Augustin, whoever wants to go first.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if you're pointing at him, me, and now we're both on the list, but that's okay. I am carrying an Office of Independent or Inspector General. And I think listening to you, and I know we've met a couple of times about this, I think one of the things that is noticeable and the reason for the bill moving forward was that there is a gap and there is so much that you can do. And I respect, again, so much of what you do, but I think we've all learned that there is still this gap that could be filled by an independent Inspector General's office. And what we really envision is it being an independent authority or oversight authority. And that can complement what the OLA does. And I've met with many of the members here in our committee about just making sure that their voice is heard. You know, what is it that you are looking for when we do establish something that has that that freedom to be independent and work really just for the people of Minnesota and not beholden to other things? So I didn't anticipate talking about this, and I think we'll save it for when we actually do the bill hearing, but I should, you know, just let everybody know in the committee too, our bill that I'm proud to say is very bipartisan, not just in the bill authors, but truly in the sense that Republicans and Democrats both had a hand in writing this bill, is to respect the work of the OLA, and then how can we fill in that missing gap and then work together to be able to accomplish what you add on to what you're doing and just really provide more government efficiency. So I hope that it's not seen as being this versus that. In fact, I see it as a future partnership, and that's really the goal of the bill, is to any way that we can address the fraud, waste, and abuse is what we want to accomplish. So a little bit of a preview, I guess, but that's it. Thank you.
Senator Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Randall, if my memory serves me correctly, once a year you audit the procedures inside of the constitutional offices, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Barr, we are auditing the constitutional offices on a 4-year rotation.
Senator Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Randall, could you tell me what the next two up are?
Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Barr. So we have just released one on the state auditor's office. We released that yesterday, and we just kicked off one on the office of the governor. And then we will take a break. We will skip the next year. It's an election year. And then we will go back to the Secretary of State and the Attorney General.
Senator McQuaid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to be really clear that I'm asking this as an information seeking and not to affirm like a bill or a position. Our neighboring states, like Michigan, Wisconsin, have full-time legislatures, and I think in one of those states they do like an oversight session that's later in their year. And I've made the comment before, like it doesn't always feel like we're a co-equal branch of government because we're not full-time and the other two are. Maybe in your work with other legislative auditors throughout the country, do you find that there is benefit in having more time for the legislature to provide oversight, at, like being time-bound the way we are, or has it not mattered that much, or are OIG and OLA providing everything we need? I guess I'm just wondering where our role fits in here.
Ms. Randall, if you dare.
thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator McQuaid. I do communicate regularly with other legislative auditors, and the issue of full-time legislature hasn't come up, to be honest, so there's that. I will say, you know, we are here, OLA is here full-time, of course, and is kind of your full-time oversight arm to the extent that we can be that. And I will also note that last week we released an update report on program evaluations and special reviews we had released in the prior 3 years. And we had a hearing on that report yesterday in the Senate Finance Committee. And it was, and I don't know that anybody here is on that committee, no, but it was, you should go watch it. It was a really interesting, it was a really interesting committee because it brought back to the legislature's, you know, collective consciousness, these reports we had released earlier, right? And some of the recommendations have been implemented, and a lot of them have been. Some of them, the agency said they've been implemented, but we couldn't confirm that. We would need to do more work. Some of them hadn't been implemented. And so I think that could be a really good tool for you all to pick up maybe where you left off and ask questions. Mm-hmm. And in the presentation yesterday, the example we used for not implemented was the legislature. Because we make a lot of recommendations to the legislature, and guess what? You don't implement all of them. And that's fine, right? And we use the legislature intentionally, one, to not point a finger at any one agency, but also so that you all could reflect on that to say, well, yeah, sometimes we don't agree with their recommendation, or there's other priorities we have, or, you know, whatever. And so it's not to say, oh, they didn't implement it, shame, right? It's like, oh, they didn't implement it, let's talk about that. Do they have a good reason, right? Why didn't they? Do they disagree? Do they have a different option? Things like that. So I sidestepped your initial question, but there's other ways maybe to use the information and tools that already exist to maybe help to make up for some of the part-time nature of the legislature.
Senator McQuaid.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And I'm wondering if the answer is, oh, we already have that and you just haven't seen it yet, I will retract my words, but is there maybe a way for in the reports or in the recommendations, if there was a, because like some of them are, you know, strengthen your IT protocols, right? That's not for the legislature, that's for the agency itself. If there was one that's like, here's the list of legislative recommendations, legislatively implicated recommendations, I think it would maybe go a long way, because when you're reading a report, you're like, yeah, that sounds like a good idea, but never does it say like, and you do this and, you know, they do that. That could be really useful for a legislator like me who's interested in doing it but finds the next step pretty daunting with a sea of recommendations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator McQuaid. Yes. So, I mean, the short answer is yes. We can point to those, and we do that in our program evaluations and special reviews. We will say, recommendation, the legislature should. It's less common in the financial audit, performance audits like this one at the lottery, where it's more focused on the agency's internal controls. But I will send to you, I'll send it to all members, the link to our update report. And in there, the update report is organized by agency, and then the legislature is listed as one of the entities, and so then you can look at the whole long list.
Well, it looks like most of my questions, I've been crossing them off as we've been going along because everybody's covered them. But and that goes for both sides of the aisle. I think overall, again, thank you to the OLA. Thanks for the report. I appreciate the lottery showed up today and had a good conversation with you. Ultimately, I think everybody sitting in this table unanimously wants to see the lottery succeed and have an OLA follow up a year from now that looks like everything's been addressed and worked on. So. You mentioned a little tiny bit of administrative rulemaking needs to do. It seems as though, and of course, this is a 40-page report, and I've had about 40 minutes to look at it. So it seems like everything is either already addressed, and, you know, as far as the negative findings go, anything has been addressed either in law or internal policy as we've gone through. So I guess I'm curious, when you mentioned a change to law or statute of some kind, or what the administrative rulemaking changes would be, and you don't really need to answer this right now because I'm sure there's more to the story. But long story short, I was going to say, if there needs to be changes in law, we need to do that quick. I shouldn't say quick. I should say as rapidly as possible, just so we can implement these changes so you can, if there is requirements in law. So that being said, members, it looks like that comes to the end of our agenda. Next Tuesday, Chairman Jong has the gavel, and I don't know, we had a little bit of head start on the agenda for next week, but we'll send that out when we get it put together. So Anything? Other than that, we stand adjourned. Thank you.